Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Morning, David Cruz in for Brian Lehr on WNYC and WNYC.org. Service providers estimate that gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender teens account for between 20 and 40% of all homeless people. That may be a surprising statistic to many of you, but it speaks to the marginalized lives that young gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people live in the city. Kai Wright's new book, Drifting Towards Love, offers a glimpse into the lives of three young gay men of color in Brooklyn as they struggle to find their place in a world that is not always so welcoming. Kai Wright is a writer and editor whose work has appeared in Essence and The Village Voice, among other publications. He joins us now in our studios. Kai, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So your book profiles three young men living in Brooklyn, Manny, Julius, and Carlos. What was the inspiration for you to tell these stories, and what's the process like in terms of how you gain the trust of these three guys?
Well, the inspiration is, you know, I've been writing about sexual politics and public health for about 10 years, telling stories about the problems, like the one that you've mentioned with homelessness, and that's certainly just one of many problems that young folks the three I profile face. But the book was an effort to step back from the problem. We address them from the point of problem too often, and talk about the larger context in which they live, and what they're doing in their lives. And that larger context is something that's actually quite universal. It's just a search for love. It's a search for belonging. Which is something we're all engaged in, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's something I'm engaged in, you're engaged, we're all trying to find a place where we fit. And they just face such exceptional barriers to finding that. From homelessness to HIV, they end up in a lot of difficult situations as a result.
So what's the process like? How did you first choose these three teenagers, and how do you go about involving yourselves in their lives?
It's quite difficult, actually. I mean, over the course of reporting the book, which started in reporting some smaller articles, the story kept getting in the way. I would meet a young person and connect with them either through one conversation or a few conversations, and then they disappear into the ether, into the criminal justice system, into homelessness, into all kinds of the problems that come up. They have such volatile and unstable lives. And that came up a lot. Secondly, I kept meeting folks who I felt, well, this is too exceptional of a story. This isn't universal enough.
Right.
This person's story will be able to be dismissed as something out of the ordinary. And what I finally realized is that all the stories are exceptional.
Yeah.
And so ultimately,
in this case, the exceptional is the rule.
Yeah. And so ultimately, the young men that are in the book, and we can talk about why I focused on men. The young men that are in the book are people that, frankly, were tied to me in some way through a shared contact. And so I was able to both gain their trust because they had trust of the person that introduced us, and be present in their lives because I could keep up with them through our shared friends.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehr on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking with Kai Wright. He's the author of Drifting Towards Love. We want to take some of your calls on this, too. If you're a gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person of color, how much do the experience that we're talking about sound like your life? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So why men?
Ultimately, it became a logistics question. Mm-hmm. Those were, I think, because I am a black gay man, those are the folks I was able to connect with and the network I had. But also, I think that this... there's so much to be written on this, and the experiences from a young person who's facing gender questions, who's transgender and wondering, you know, I don't fit, my gender doesn't fit my body, and what do I do about it, or a young woman who's lesbian, that versus a young gay man, those are such distinct experiences. It's all about space in the end. It's all about space to find yourself. And I think depending on, I think gender plays a role. Gender, and as I apply in the book, race as well, plays a role in what kind of space you're able to get. So it was a unique. So I ultimately decided let's focus on the young men and take one piece of it and hope folks pick it up from there.
Yeah, as if being young and gay in America wasn't tough enough. What are some of the additional challenges that the young men in your book have had to deal with?
Well, it's so again, you know, they like all of us are searching for space, searching for love. It is the elusiveness of that space, both in the literal sense. So there's one of the young men I profile who lives in East New York. His life is about a mile wide. His block and the next few blocks over, his family and his friends. That's really where he's rooted. If you go to East New York, there's no boutiques with rainbow flags.
Right.
There's no gay public. You know, we have five gay publications in New York City. None of them circulate in East New York. He never saw gay people. Period. There was just in terms of public space in the world he navigated, it wasn't there, and he didn't turn on the radio or TV and hear love songs or see love stories that at least put gay in his culture. And in any way he could relate to. And so he literally had no public space. And then laid on top of that was, and this is something I think we take for granted, is the mental and emotional space to deal with stuff going on inside us. So he came from a family that had very real acute challenges. They, you know, in his early childhood, he grew up in the midst of a drug war. His family faced homelessness themselves due to the dilapidated housing stock they were living in and problems they had there. He had very serious health problems in his family. So all of these things seemed so much more acute than who he wanted to sleep with. But in reality, that was quite acute for him as well. So he had to figure out how to deal with that.
It's an interesting dichotomy that, you know, you could argue that these men are growing up in a country that's never been more accepting of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender lifestyles. But what are some of the messages that Manny and Julius and Carlos were getting about homosexuality while they were growing up?
Right. I mean, well, and they had some different experiences, but in the best case, so Carlos, in the best case scenario, is someone who was just getting no message whatsoever.
Yeah.
Right? He just heard nothing. It was just radio silence. And he had to figure out what to do with this feeling like a three-legged dog. In the worst case scenarios, who was another character, someone like Julius, who is receiving active homophobia, you know, who is being told that his feelings are depraved and had no other outlet had no counterweight to that.
Yeah.
And so when it went in search of his own counterweight, and that's where a lot of the homelessness comes in, where folks just can't stay at home because they just they can't. The brutality at home is greater than the brutality of sleeping on the street.
Yeah, the potential danger of being out in the street. Right. Let's talk about Julius a little bit. He is originally from rural Florida. And he comes to the city that has been the magnet for gay youth forever, right?
Right. It's great. As one of my friends put it, reading the book, who related to the story of Julius, you know, and he said, you know, it's like all New Yorkers. Many of us show up with a bus ticket and a dream,
right.
You know.
Right.
And Julius showed up with a bus ticket and dream. He was escaping an abusive foster family down in Florida, and notably the abuse he was getting there. Was less about gay than just he was, you know, him and his foster siblings were just a source of income for his foster parents. And so he managed that part well. What he couldn't manage was how to find space to be gay. And so he stole a little money and saved a little money and got a bus ticket and came up to, rode his bus to freedom up to New York. But when he got here, he arrived to nothing. He arrived to no work. He arrived with no resources, either emotional, mental, or financial. He spent about 3 years here before he fled, And they were brutal. He spent most of them on the streets. He was confident of his skills to put together a life. And truth be told, he did. He lived through it. To have so few resources, his skill was remarkable. But it meant hustling. It meant going from shelters to shelter. It meant doing a lot of things that put him at risk for everything from disease.
These are three distinct lives. What's the commonality among them?
What is the commonality? I think, returning to the universal point, I think the commonality is that they are desperately seeking a place to belong. That they are not at all confused about who they are. They are not all confused about what they want to achieve. They want to achieve a life where they can be gay. They can love men. They can have that as be part of their entire existence. They're not confused about that, and they face extreme barriers in getting it. And so I think that's the commonality. We talk so much about. When we talk about gay men, we talk so much about the problems, at least mm-hmm. with gay men, we talk so much about people who are in the closet, and how that impacts people. These are young people who are nowhere near a closet.
Right.
They're very clear on what they want. And there's just so little out there, either from within the gay community or from within the communities of color that they relate to also, that's there for them.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking with Kai Wright, author of Drifting Towards Love. We want to take some of your phone calls on this. We're looking to talk with everyone, including gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender young people of color. How much does the experience that Kai writes about in his book relate to your life? Are there similarities? Are there differences? Our number here is 1-212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Kai, you talk about your own process of self-acceptance and having to overcome the idea that black and gay identity couldn't coexist. You wrote, in fact, that I knew gay people to be white people. How much of an obstacle is that for the young men that you profiled?
Well, I mean, I think and it was differing levels of obstacles for each of them. But I think it's about about having no example of a life of the life that you could lead. And that's Carlos is the best example of it, of having no. Of seeing not you can turn on the TV nowadays and you can see gay life.
Right.
So he lives 30-minute ride away from Gay Pride, from one of the largest gay pride celebrations in the country. But it meant nothing to him. It related to him in no way, shape, or form, because he didn't see any of it in his community.
Where was the disconnect? Was it a racial disconnect, class disconnect?
I think it's easy to put it on. I mean, we can put the sort of big picture labels on it. It's mm-hmm. race, it's class, but it's also one-on-one. It's also on a much, much lower level than that. He had a certain image of himself as Carlos Puerto Rican, and he had a certain image of himself as a Puerto Rican man. And that was, and you consume that from his brothers, from his father, from the celebrities that he looked up to, and he was trying to build a life as that sort of Puerto Rican man. He had no point of reference for a Puerto Rican man who was gay.
Yeah,
literally none.
He probably related more to the Puerto Rican Day Parade
absolutely.
And all of that than
far
gay
more.
Pride. Yeah,
absolutely. And there was no gay float in the Puerto Rican
right,
Day Parade.
Right.
So I think it, and I've had conversations with folks, and I think this is an important point to make, is that people say, oh, well, does this mean that, black communities, Latino communities are more homophobic than other communities? And I think that's the wrong question. It's not a comparative question about the level of homophobia. It's more about how the homophobia is felt, because racial identity and cultural belonging are so important to a lot of us as people of color, and certainly to the young men in the book. If there isn't space within that community for you, that becomes then it's felt even more acutely.
David Cruz for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking with Kai Wright, author of Drifting Towards Love. When we come back, we'll take some of your phone calls. David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. Back with Kai Wright, author of Drifting Towards Love. We'll take your phone calls at 212-433-9692. I want to pick up on what we were talking about before the break. Maybe there are some Puerto Rican or Latino or African American families or members of the gay community who are also Black and Latino who maybe want to talk a little bit more about this question of identity that you touched on a little bit. The number is 212-433-WNYC. Let's take Kyle, who's with us from Manhattan. Kyle, welcome to the program. Hi, Kyle. Kyle, you there? I'm sure I screwed that up, but Kyle, if you get a chance, call us. Is that Kyle there? No? All right, so let's go back with Kai, who we do know is here. Let's expand on that a little bit, the whole question of being, in the case of one of your subjects, Puerto Rican or Black in the United States. How much, you know, you talked about how there was this perception that homophobia is more prevalent in Latino and Black communities. Have you found that to be the case, or is just that homophobia is everywhere?
I think homophobia is everywhere. I think that I actually find often that there is, well, I want to avoid the relative question, but you, for instance, rarely see the evangelical type leaders that trade on homophobia for their career in the Black or Latino community that you see in white churches, yeah, for instance, or white from white politicians. You rarely see a Black politician who's trading on homophobia. So I think that in some ways we can say that it's not as profound. But again, I think the point is that I try to get folks away from comparing the two and thinking about rather how it's received. And for people of color, I know certainly for myself, growing up, my being part of a Black family, part of a Black community was very important to me. And certainly for all of the young folks in this book, it's not only very important, but it's just the only reality they know. And so in the absence of space within that community, they are left with fewer options. So, you know, and I think one of the good examples of how that turns into risk is if you look at a dispute that's been going on down around Christopher Street in the Village for a few years now. You know, it's an area where queer Black and Latino kids from all over the tri-state region come every night, particularly in the summer, and have been since before the Stonewall riots, since the 50s. As that area has become more valuable to the city and the real estate market, they have been much less welcome there in recent years, and a pitched battle has been going on for control over that space. But what's significant to me about that is less about the fight between the condo owners in the Village and the Black and Latino kids that are there, and more about the fact that they had to come from Newark to this pier off the edge of Lower Manhattan in order to find a place where they could be together and be open and be out. What if they could stay in Newark? Then we would have never had, we wouldn't be having that debate, and they wouldn't be getting into the ton of problems that they do in fact get into down there. And, you know, a young woman, Sakia Gunn, a few years back was killed. She was a New York resident, stabbed to death in her transit, and she was in transit between
she
her
was
home
coming back from
and,
there
and the Village,
or at least from the city. Anyway.
Yeah, well, from the Village. Yeah. So if we spent as a community, both as Black and Latino communities and as a gay community, more time on developing space for folks in Newark, in East New York, in the South Bronx, in the places where folks like Manny and Julius and Carlos come from, then that would change the dynamic dramatically. So it's less about how homophobic it is there and more about how important that it is for them to have a place at home and how much and how little is being done around that within any community.
All right. I think I found Kyle in Manhattan. Kyle, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Kyle Merker, and I'm the chair of the Ali Fournet Center, which is a shelter and transitional housing and drop-in center for gay, lesbian, transgender, homeless youth in Manhattan and Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to point out is that this is really a problem that the gay community really needs to own and step up to, because it is a problem that the gay community, we can really make a change. You know, David, you had said earlier that the country has never been more accepting of gay people before, and I think that's true. But at the same time, I think they've never been more intolerant. And kids are encouraged to come out younger and younger. You know, they see Queer Eye for the straight guy, and they see Will and Grace, and they think, well, this is great. I just have to announce it. And then turns out they live in a very intolerant family in a very intolerant neighborhood, and they end up on the streets. And as you say, they save their money. They get a bus ticket, and they go to a large metropolitan area. We as gay people need to recognize that our success of being able to come out and being able to stand up and say that we're proud has some fallout, and that fallout are these kids. And we, as a community, need to take care of these kids.
All right, Kyle, thanks very much for your call. How much of that, I mean, obviously you would agree with that, Kai.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And the thing is that, and it's not a small problem either. I mean, we've talked a few times about homelessness, but there's all kinds of things to show that that gay youth really deserve a much higher place on our agenda. You look at HIV in the city. If you look at HIV rates, infection rates amongst gay men, they're plummeting amongst men over 30. The epidemic is, I mean, there's still a problem clearly, but the numbers are going down. They're skyrocketing amongst young men under 29 and under. They're I think, and then if you look at for men under 20, 90% of them, 93% of them are Black or Latino. We have a really crucial problem with youth, and it goes beyond HIV as well. I mean, if you look at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, does a biannual survey of what risky things are going on with kids around the country. In some states, they ask about sexual orientation, and what we find is they're more likely to join gangs, they're more likely to use drugs, they're less likely to wear their seatbelts on every aspect.
They're in crisis. Kyle talked about Will and Grace and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Queer as Folk. How much do the images of young gay people of color differ from the images, or I guess we'd have to call it the prevailing image of gay life in America?
Right. Well, I mean, there is very little image of gay life in America that involves people of color in terms of in popular culture. I was having a conversation the other day, I should say that that's slowly changing and we need more of it. I was having a conversation the other day with a young man who is 19 and a college student. He is writing some about his experience as a young gay man, and from a small town in Illinois, and he was saying how he can remember being in sixth grade, and turning on Queer Eye, turning on Queer as Folk, and how foreign and strange it seemed to him, and then in recent years he was able to turn on a program called Noah's Ark, which was a program about sort of Sex in the City for Black gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it, and I hadn't realized how far into the culture it had reached that this kid in rural Illinois was able to find that, and how much of a difference it made for him, in terms of being able to see a reality that he might be able to grow up and be an adult that's out and gay and has a life and has a career, and it's not a situation where he has to either hide or be in pain.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking with Kai Wright, author of the book Drifting Towards Love. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. E is with us from New York, New York. E, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad that the person from the Ali Forney Center called, because I was hoping that someone would call with expert like perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly not an expert, but I just wanted to comment that that these issues are not new, and that they've been around for quite a while, and there are organizations like the Ali Forney Center, and I think that there's another place called the Sylvia Rivera Project, and other organizations in New York City that deal with homeless LGBT youth and try to find places for them to stay. And I know that I've attended, I'm not an activist, but I'm interested in these issues, and I try to do what I can to inform myself and other people, especially queer people and, you know, straight, you know, and straight people. But I attended something about 2 years ago at St. John the Divine. It was a forum with all these organizations, the ones that I've mentioned, and other church groups who were actively, like, opening their churches for queer youth who are homeless to have them to have a place to stay. Because this is a problem that's gone on for quite a while. And it's not just a New York City problem. It's a national problem. I'm not an expert, so I don't have, you know.
Yeah, we talked about Newark just a few minutes ago.
Excuse me?
We talked about Newark just a few minutes ago.
But it's not, you know, in urban centers across the country, because people in the rural towns, they'll go to their nearest, you know, urban center, you know, hoping to find acceptance and hoping, you know, to have a better life and so forth.
Can you tell me a little bit about your experience, how maybe some of these organizations were able to help you?
Well, I've never been homeless.
Mm-hmm.
I'm queer, but I've never been homeless. I'm a person of color, but I'm interested in these issues, just particularly for you, just youth issues. I mean, I'm young myself, but, you know, I just think it's a shame. And I've been waiting for the longest time for WNYC to talk about queer issues and youth issues, because I often feel like often when people talk about homelessness, there's this part of the population that's totally ignored. I mean, there are homeless adults, you know, homeless queer, you know, adults that are around, just, you know, as well as the kids. And I just feel like it's a, you know, it's a population that's not been, you know, talked about. And I just wanted to add like a voice, because unfortunately, you know, and I understand, because some people are, you know, are not comfortable, who are persons of color, of talking and speaking out, you know, and I just wanted to add another voice to it, you know. And I'm hoping that other, you know, organizations with, you know, leaders who are, you know, entrenched in these issues and deal with these issues, that they could call, or someone who's well versed, you know, someone other than myself. But, you know, hopefully that, you know, just, you know, brought something to the table. But like I said, there are churches, you know, and I don't remember the list of churches, but there are churches from different denominations that have opened up their church to youth to give them a place to stay.
All right, E, let me get some other calls in here. I appreciate the phone call.
Okay, bye.
On the specifics of homelessness, there are two things I'd like to say about what you said. One is that in terms of nationally, yes, it's an issue. There, you know, I think at last count they had the estimates were anywhere from 600,000 to 1.6 million kids on the street any given night in the country, mm-hmm. and then anywhere from 25% to 40% of those are believed to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, and in the city, it's 3,000 to 6,000. And in WNYC's defense, I think you did a program on this a couple months back. In terms of what resources are available out there is the Ali Forney Center, and there's a couple of other places. But there are, when I was doing the book, at my count, it was a little over 100 beds, ranging from emergency overnight shelters to long-term housing that were specifically set aside for gay kids, when 25 to 40% of the 3,000 to 8,000 kids that are homeless are gay, and so now these are folks who are homeless specifically because they felt like, I'd rather sleep in the street than sleep at home because of my sexuality.
Or even in some cases in a shelter, right?
Or in a shelter. And then when you have with the shelters, and this is part of why sitting aside the space is important, is that there's a lot of anecdotal reports of gay kids who just do not feel safe in mainstream shelters. They're particularly the ones who are, you know, if they're effeminate men or masculine women, they are picked on, they are beat up, they are sexually assaulted, and they are, and often not just by other clients, but by staff as well. And so having, within all of that, there's about 100 beds set aside for them. So the need is far outweighs the resources that exist. And if nothing else, we ought to turn to that.
Yeah. Let me get Vinny in here. Vinny is in Queens. Vinny, welcome to the program.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure, I'm very well.
Hi, my name is Vinay, actually, and
I used
to manage the Sexual Minority Youth Recreation Center in Portland, Oregon, and there's a really great model there. Unfortunately, there's never enough funding. The model is that there was an educational component that would go out into the community, into public schools, into businesses, and we would educate. We would take young people with us to educate teachers, students, and people just in the community about the issues that queer youth face. I don't know if Ali Fornai has anything comparable, but that seemed like, it seems like, yes, as queer adults, we need to take care of the young people and be there for them. But I think there's also a huge educational component that is missing in mass culture. We do see all this stuff on TV. It's thrown out there. And then, you know, the kids are supposed to just come out and deal with their lives. What we found is that kids were coming from all over the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington to Portland because we had a center, we had recreation, we had a safe facility. But then where do they go from there? They go to the streets, they find drugs, they find, you know, clubs and whatnot. And so I just wanted to find out if there's anything like that, an educational component in New York City that is far-reaching. The other thing that was developed in Portland, Oregon, is a queer fostering system where they're looking for queer adults to help young people, you know, live in the city, move in, and have some place to go that is a safe place with queer adults that understand their needs when these young people are getting kicked out of their homes right and left.
All right, Vinny, let me get Kai to respond to that. I appreciate your call.
Yeah, I mean, I
just really quickly.
There are some resources. I think the problem that I hear folks talk about that are doing the work is that there is so much, the interaction between gay adults and gay youth is so stigmatized as sexualized and predatory that gay adults, for a variety of reasons, don't want to participate in anything involving youth. And so they have a really hard time finding volunteers to either go out and speak about it or to be these mentors and foster parents for gay youth, because both within the gay community and within the larger society, we've so defined cross-generational interaction as predatory and sexual that there's so little space left for it.
And so many roadblocks, even the whole question of class as well.
Right. And the volunteers that they find are disproportionately gay, are disproportionately white men.
All right. Kai Wright is the author of Drifting Towards Love. David Cruz, in for Brian Lehr on WNYC and WNYC.org. Kai, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
When we return, we'll talk about the situation in Pakistan.